Welcome to our sermon series on relationships. The Bible gives us clear instruction as to what is good in a relationship and what is not. This sermon series will unpack biblical truth to help us grow healthy and strong relationships. Have your Bible ready, and let's begin.
I am a big fan of stories where one person helps another. I love when we get to see people like who are better because of the relationships they're in. They believe in each other. They call out something better in one another. I love stories where you get to see somebody grow because of knowing somebody else. In that relationship with somebody else, they tried something courageous because of who believed in them, or they tried something new because of what they saw in somebody else. I love these kind of stories. I always gravitate towards them. I always love reading them and hearing about them or watching them, and I always feel so encouraged and inspired by them when I do. But what happens on the flip side? What about the relationships where we aren't better because of them? The relationships that don't necessarily make us a better person. Maybe they leave us feeling more insecure about ourselves or about life, or the relationships that leave us feeling exhausted and drained all of the time. The relations where we find ourselves feeling not good enough or lacking in some way over and over again. The relationships that don't necessarily call out the best in us, but sometimes speak to the worst of us, or sometimes the unhealthiest side of us. What about the relationships that are constant fight again and again and again? Or the ones where you find yourself like chasing approval that somehow you can never get to, or trying to balance out like that invisible scorecard that you can't keep up with. Like, you know it's there. You know it's heavily weighted against you and all the mistakes are there and nothing you do is balancing them out. What happens to the relationships that are untrustworthy or where they're unreliable, or the pain and drama of them seems to be never, ever ending? The truth is, in life, we experience good and bad relationships. We live through relationships that are good for us and make us better men and women because we are part of them. And we also live through relationships that aren't good or healthy for us. Sometimes we find it in our family, or we find it with a significant other. For some of us, it's friendships we've acquired along the years, or for some, it's extended family or even in-laws. We know not all relationships are created equal, and not all are absolutely healthy. But also, through them, we learn our way forward. We learn who we are, and sometimes we learn who we shouldn't be. We learn about ourselves, we learn about others, we learn to decide what is healthy for us and what isn't. And hopefully, in these relationships, we learn the possibility and the potential of who we can be. I want to lean into this a little bit more, looking at relationships today, and we're going to look at it through the life of a man named Samson. We find his life in the book of Judges in the Old Testament, and it's a really interesting time period in the history of God's people, the Israelites. They had moved towards this promised land that God had given them. He showed up and he rescued them from slavery, and he brought them through the wilderness, and for 40 years they wandered, and they finally got to this promised land, and Joshua led them into these new places, and it was beautiful and thriving and flowing with milk and honey. And as they settled into this new established land, unfortunately, they started turning from God. There's this repeatable pattern you see in the book of Judges. They would turn from God and do what they said was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they would come under this intense oppression from their enemies and the neighboring communities, and they would cry out to God for help. God would show up and he'd raise up a judge for them, and he would deliver them from their problems and deliver them from their troubles. And in Judges 13, we see a woman who was visited by an angel. She, up to this point, had no kids, and the angel showed up and said that she and her husband were going to have kids. They were going to have a son, and that this son was going to begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines, which was an impressive enemy that was making life miserable. And so this woman gave birth to a son, and they named him Samson, and the spirit of the Lord began to stir in him, and Samson was called to be this leader, this judge among the people, and he was given unique talents and abilities, and he was strong in a way that others weren't strong. He had all of this potential to do good in this community and to lead his people and to help rescue them. But one of the first things we see about the life of Samson when his life story unfolds is he was selfish. Anytime he defeats the enemy, it was more almost incidental to just doing what he wanted to do because he wanted to do it. We see this moment, he's out one day and he sees this woman, this daughter of the Philistines, and he decides he wants to marry her. This is the girl that he wants to marry. So he goes back to his parents and he says, I want you to get her for me as my wife. And his parents are like, man, Samson, I don't know if this is a good idea. Like, they try to convince him not to marry her, this girl who is tied to their enemy, this woman who has living among the very people who were making their life hard, and her whole background, her whole upbringing stood in contrast to his own. She was literally connected to the very people who actively hated Samson's people. And so his parents are like, man, buddy, I don't think this is a good idea. Like, couldn't you find a woman among our people and marry her? Like, I don't know if you've ever tried to convince somebody not to date someone before. Usually this doesn't go well, right? Like, they nod at you, they smile, and they're like, yeah, I'm doing it anyways. And so that's what Samson does. And he says to his parents, like, this is the girl. She's right in my eyes. He demanded of them that they get her for as a wife. So Samson marries her, and they have this huge feast for a week where everybody gets together to like celebrate the marriage, and everybody's there from the Philistines and from Samson's side. And Samson's also an arrogant man. He's very aware of his abilities, and he decides to make this bet with the people there from his bride's side. There's like 30 people from the Philistines, and he says, here's the deal. I'm going to give you this riddle. And if you can solve the answer to this riddle, then I'm going to pay you. If you can't solve the answer to the riddle, then you're going to pay me. So they're like, all right, we're in. This sounds good. So he tells them this ridiculous riddle that nobody's ever going to know the answer to. And of course, they can't figure it out. They don't know the answer. And so they decide to press Samson's wife to get the answer to the riddle for them. Now, this whole week should have been fun and celebrating and a party. Like, they're getting married and it's this new life together and it's this new special time. But instead, Samson's wife is driven by the pressure from her people to get Samson to tell her the answer. So she weeps and she begs him and she pleads with him to the answer of the riddle till he finally gives in. He tells her the answer to it. She, of course, turns around, tells these 30 people the answer. They tell Samson the answer to the riddle, and Samson gets angry. Samson loses his temper. He goes out, he murders 30 guys in Ashkelon, a city in Philistine, takes their stuff, and gives it to the other people as a prize. He's so angry at the situation, he leaves his bride behind, he goes back home, he sulks, he works his way out of his anger. When he finally pulls it together, he goes back to get his bride and finds out that the people just figured he was so angry at them that he didn't want her anymore, and they'd given her to another person to be married, and now she's married to Samson's best man. This is like drama, drama, drama going on here. So now Samson's not just angry, he's like righteously angry, and now he wants revenge on the people for what they've done, and he's clever Samson. So he goes out and finds a couple hundred foxes, kind of ties their bushy tails together, lights them on fire, and lets them loose in the Philistine, like in their standing grain and in the orchards, and he burns down all of their basic income and well-being, torches it to the ground. Now, revenge doesn't usually go without retaliation. Like, the Philistines aren't going to be like, you know what, buddy, that was deserved. We got it. No problem. Like, now they're angry and they're huge. So they gather together thousands of men and they camp out to make war against the Israelites. And they start raiding the Israelites in return. And the Israelites are like, what's going on? What did we do? And they're like, this is because of Samson, and we want Samson. You need to hand him over to us. Now, they find out, they agree, the Israelites, Samson's people, agree to tie him up and hand him over to the Philistines, the enemy. Now, here's the irony. I hope you can hear the irony in this. Samson was called by God to be a leader in his community, right? Like, he's the guy that's supposed to be a champion and rescue them from the Philistines, and they're supposed to, like, fight together and work on the side of good. But because of his selfishness and arrogance, he didn't even have a trusting relationship in his own community. Within his own people, nobody's like, man, let's protect Samson. Like, we got this, brothers in arms. Like, let's go charge the enemy. instead of fighting side by side with his friends and his family, he ends up fighting this war alone. They tie him up and hand him over to the Philistines. Now, he ended up fighting it. He came out the victor. He killed a ridiculous amount of Philistines. He fought his way out of this dangerous situation, but he did it by himself without anybody to have his back. And things don't get better in Samson's life for there. Like, he's a judge for 20 years in Israel, and we show up in Judges chapter 16, and now his selfishness, his destructive behavior have only gotten worse. And he's no better at picking women than he was before. He falls in love with a woman named Delilah. And the Philistines know this about Samson, and they use it against him. They get together all the leaders, the lords of the Philistines. They show up and they bribe Delilah with the promise of, if they can get from her, if she can find out from Samson what makes him so strong, then they'll give her all of this riches and all of this silver, and she'll be set for life. So in Judges 16:6, Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies and how you might be bound that one could subdue you." Now, this like might be a small clue into her trustworthiness. Like, "Hey, Samson, tell me how you can be defeated," right? And so he makes up some silly excuse. He said, "You know, if you bind me with 7 bowstrings that haven't been dried, I'll come out weak and be like any other man." So Delilah gets the 7 bowstrings, ties up Samson. She wakes him up and she says, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." Samson wakes up. He breaks the bowstrings. Not where his strength come from. Now, at this point, Samson should be thinking, maybe Delilah isn't trustworthy, right? Like, she asked how to defeat you. You told her something, and she did the exact thing that you told her. Maybe this isn't a great relationship. But for whatever reason, he stays. I don't know, like, what she does to convince him, but it's enough excuses. Moves on until verse 10. Delilah said to Samson, "Behold, you've mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound." Samson tells her, "If they bind me with new ropes that haven't been used, I'll become weak and be like any other man." Delilah gets new ropes. She ties up Samson. She wakes Samson up. "The Philistines are upon you." Samson jumps up. He breaks through the ropes. He's ready to fight. There's people waiting in ambush to take over Samson. A third time, Delilah says to Samson, "Until now you've mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound." So he said to her, "You weave the 7 locks of my head in the web and fasten it tight with a pin. Then I'll become weak and be like any other man." While he slept, Delilah took the 7 locks of his head, wove them into the web. She made them tight with the pin and said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he awoke from his sleep, pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web. Okay. 3 times is a track record, right? Like, one time you can excuse away, you can fluff it off is no big deal. 3 times is a track record of somebody telling you what kind of a person that they are. Delilah gets Samson to tell him, and each time he tells her, she acts on the thing that he says. She ties him up. She weaves his hair. 3 times, Samson is shown that Delilah is going to use this information against him. 3 times, she's shown she's not going to care for these secrets. 3 times, she's shown her readiness to quickly turn against him. Like, I don't know if there's like a picture definition of a toxic relationship, but this is a good image right here, right? Like, if you do the thing that is against me 3 times, that's probably a clue that you shouldn't be trustworthy. But Samson doesn't leave. He doesn't say, like, "You know, girl, this has been fun, but we're kind of at an impasse here. You clearly are going to hand me over to the bad guys. I don't want to be handed over, so we're just going to part ways," right? He doesn't leave. He stays. And it goes on. Verse 15, she says, "How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You've mocked me 3 times, and you've not told me where your great strength is." When she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. He told her all his heart and said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head. I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me and I shall become weak and be like any other man." mean, it seems obvious, I know. Outside looking in, we always have more clarity. But, like, at this point, what is Samson expecting to happen, right? Like, she's shown what she's going to do. She's going to act on it. I know every one of you men in your head are thinking right now, I know why he gave in. She nagged him to death, right? Like, he couldn't take one more nagging, and if he had to listen to it for one more day, he was vexed unto death. Been there, yeah? Okay, what is he expecting to happen? She's shown him exactly what she's going to do. She acts on the information that Samson gives her. When Samson is asleep, she calls somebody in, they shave his head, the Philistines show up, they seize him, they take him prisoner, they gouge out his eyes and bind him in shackles and put him to work in the prison, working in grinding in the mill. We don't know how long Samson is kept prisoner there, but his hair starts to grow back, some of his strength returns, and one day they bring him out of the prison, they bring him into this room where thousands of Philistines have gathered, and they decide to make sport of him. This great Samson, this strong Samson who's supposed to deliver his people, is now their prisoner. He's weak, he's blind, they want to laugh at him and make sport of him. And so he stands there in this room. He has the servants put his hands on the two columns holding up the room together, and then he prays. In verse 28, Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me. Please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes. He prays for revenge, to get back at the Philistines for what they've done to him. So Samson presses against these two pillars. He has enough strength to bring them down. The whole building collapses. He dies along with the thousands of men and women who are in the building that day. And in his death, he defeats the most people he's ever defeated. But listen how sad this is. Verse 31. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah, his father. His family's left to pick up these broken pieces. The life of Samson is so sad. Like, I know maybe some of us grew up and we're like the hero Samson, right? With his hair and his strength and the mighty things that he did. But he's actually a sad story. He starts off with all of this potential and he's called to do this good work and he's given all the tools he needs to succeed. But his life is derailed by his own selfishness and his own lack of control. He ends up having these unhealthy relationships that don't call out anything better in him, but instead perpetuate more pain and more tragedy. Anytime we come upon a story like this, like anytime I read something hard in the Bible, I'm like, man, God, why is this in the Bible, right? Like, why is this the thing that you want us to learn from and think about? Because it's there for a reason. It's not a throwaway story. God wants us to contemplate the life of Samson and learn from it and grow from what we learn about his life. So I want to give us a couple things. I'm going to give us three things that I really want us to spend time thinking about this week. So if you're jotting anything down, these are good three ideas to think about. They're in the notes in the app section. You can use your bulletin, your phone, wherever you want to jot them down. Here's the first thing I want us to see. A selfish life is destructive. When we live selfishly, it has an unhealthy effect, not just on us, but on the people around us. Now, when we think about selfishness, let's have a good idea, a good definition in our head. This kind of selfishness is defined as being concerned excessively or exclusively for yourself. You are concerned mostly about yourself, your pleasure, your welfare, regardless of other people, many times at the expense of other people. Now, to be clear, selfishness is not self-care. You're not a selfish person by being a healthy person and taking care of yourself and being healthy boundaries and those good things. This is instead being so concerned about what you want, so concerned with your own life, that you can't even see how you're hurting the people around you in the pursuit of those things. Samson was selfish. And his selfishness trickled out and hurt the people around him. His life was about what he wanted when he wanted it, with no regard to how it affected those around him. He wanted a wife, right? His family should get him that wife. He was angry at the men for getting the riddle right, and his wife paid the price of that ugly moment. Now, it's always easy outside looking in to see the selfishness of other people, right? Especially in our relationships. If forced to, we could sit down and write a list of all of the times we've seen or experienced selfishness of the people that we're doing life with, right? We all have the person in the family who hijacks the conversation. You could be talking about the Indians, and somehow they will pull it around back to them and why life is miserable for them, right? Like, wow, isn't it a beautiful sunny day? They will suck up that conversation and, given the space, tell you why life is miserable and make it all about them. The person that you work with in the office, right? They're just a wrecking ball and completely oblivious about the people who are next to them. Or the kids who want what they want when they want it because they want it, and that's it, end of story. The in-laws who are maybe passive aggressive, but they're really good at making you know where you're lacking, and they're not, right? Like the comparison that happens. Or the significant other who expects and demands without ever giving anything in return. We could put a list together of the selfishness and how people don't appreciate us and all that we do. It's super hard to turn that lens back around on ourselves and say, how am I being selfish? It's so much harder to look at our own life and say, how are my selfish choices, my selfish life actions affecting the people around me? The selfishness that says how I feel matters more than how you feel. The selfishness that demands what I need is the most important thing, regardless of how it affects anybody else. The selfishness that makes everyone around us make everything just about us. The selfishness that might look a little bit like having trouble working with other people. It's hard to work in a group when you're a selfish person. Because if people don't do what you want them to do, how you want them to do it, then you just won't have it. And you'd rather do it by yourself than not be able to control the entire situation, right? Or it might look a little bit like finding yourself blaming the world for everything that's wrong, right? If the world wasn't against me, if the world wasn't out to get me, the world is actively out to get me. Or it might even pop up in the ability to never feel happy, to never feel content with what we have, and constantly saying, if I just had this, then my life would be good. Or constantly getting more and more and more, and never feeling content or good enough with what we have. These layers of selfishness, they're destructive to our well-being, and there's always a cost to the people around us doing life with us. But we're able to push back. Yes, selfishness comes very easy to us. Nobody has to teach you when you are little to think about yourself. You just do, right? Nobody has to teach us as an adult. It happens naturally. But we are able to push back at the unhealthy places that selfishness comes up in our life. And it starts with us looking for it. Awareness is like the basic standing living ground for doing life well. Once you are aware, you can see things and act on them. We're really good at being unaware, right? Like, some of us are like gifted in the ability to close our eyes, turn a blind eye, put up the blinders, and just act like it doesn't exist. But one of the hardest but best works we can do for ourselves is to become fully aware people. And when we look for it and we do honest checks on ourselves and say, how am I being selfish? This awareness is the first step. What if just for a week we kept a track and we said, this is what I think is selfish behavior or selfish choices or selfish language. And anytime we do them, we just make a little dash mark. We just keep a running list of the things that we did. What if we tallied it up at the end of the week and we got a full view spectrum of all of these things put together? I mean, God bless you. You might only have a few, or maybe you're like a ridiculously, you're trying to work at it your whole life, selfish person, and you have a lot more. What if somewhere in between, just being able to acknowledge that it's there opens our eyes to say, this is where I'm selfish. Now I can do something about it. I can change it. I can push back on it. I can act on it. What if we stopped and listened? Because here's the truth. There's a pretty good chance that the people in our lives are giving us clues. Like, they know exactly how our selfishness is affecting them. And if we'd stop and listen, they've probably been trying to give us clues about, one, how it hurts them, or two, what we're doing that we don't see, that if we just stop and listen, we might learn something that we didn't know. And I don't mean everybody. Everybody doesn't get permission to tell you everything because their opinions are their opinions. But like the good, trustworthy, close people that you're doing life intimately with, they probably know. And they probably know what it feels like to be on the receiving end of it. And if we would just stop and listen, we might learn something we didn't know. And then once we go looking for it and we open ourselves up to listen to others, what we find is places that we can start pushing back at our own selfishness. And one of the very best things we can do to challenge the selfishness in our own lives is very simple. It's do something for somebody else. It's just looking for ways to push back against self-focus and put my focus outwards instead. It's getting out of my own space, thinking about me constantly and thinking about somebody else instead. And it's just looking for ways to help or volunteering or serving or being generous or helping somebody in need. All of these things are places where we just spend time not thinking about ourselves. Now, I don't know about you. There is a certain level of thinking that is necessary and good. And then we're really good at the rest of the part of it, which is like the constant over and over thinking about self again and again and again and again. I don't ever feel better after I spend that time. Do you? Like, I don't get to the end of that like moping for a week or feeling angry for a week or feeling upset and like how terrible everything is and get to the end of the week and be like, you know what? I'm so glad I spent that much time thinking about these things. Because one, nothing changed because I wasted all that time worrying or stressing or fretting about it. And on the flip side, I don't feel better because of it. But on the other side, I have spent time thinking about other people and felt awesome at the end of it because I just got out of my own crazy space for a little bit and was able to turn the focus outwards. Selfishness is always going to be destructive in our lives, but we are able to find ways to look inward and say, where am I being selfish and how can I push back against it? Here's the second thing I want us to see from the life of Samson: the value of a trustworthy friend. Samson wasn't doing life with anybody that he could trust. I mean, none of the women that he kept choosing had proven themselves trustworthy. They were all very willing to turn against him and hand him over to the Philistines. There were no close friends that we read about being in his life that could like pull him to side and be like, hey, bud, you're kind of being a jerk, right? Like, hey, I don't know, like maybe you, before you lose your temper, just like took a step back and like, is that really what you want to do, right? Like we all have the friends in our life that are like, before you press send on that really good, very detailed, angry email that you're about to send to everybody, maybe you just pause, right? And think for a second. Samson doesn't have anybody in his life that he's willing to listen to give him this kind of advice. Even when his family seeks to give him counsel and help him, he's very willing to dismiss them and not listen. But on the flip side of that, Samson hasn't proven himself trustworthy either. I mean, here's the guy who's supposed to be leading and championing the good cause, and decision after decision he makes are all selfishly made about what he wants, what he's going to get out of it, and what it's going to do for him. We absolutely need people in our life who can tell us the truth. We don't have great friends who only ever tell us how awesome everything is, who tell us they're the problem, we're right, they're wrong, you got this. It's nice to have that, but we also need people who are willing to say, yeah, no, right? Like, poke a hole in our egos every once in a while and be like, yeah, I know you think that, but I don't know, out of crazy town, this is true, right? Like, we need people who are willing to challenge us every once in a while and say, that's not a good thought. That's not a healthy decision. Going there isn't going to be a good place for you. We all need people who will be in our life and have our back and stand with us when things get hard. who will stand with us and challenge us when things are hard because we made it hard because of our decisions and the rippling effect of them. We all need people who can challenge us and encourage us. So the question becomes, again, who are we doing life with? Who's in our corner? Who's there that we're willing to listen to? And I know there are so many voices fighting to be heard and fighting to have control in our life, but which ones are we really giving access to because it helps us be a healthier human being in the long run? And then the flip side, how trustworthy are we in relationships? If we want to have trustworthy relationships with our spouses and our friends and the people that we do life with, our families, we have to be trustworthy people. I can't control the actions of anybody else. When it comes to other people and the choices they make, that's not my circle of influence. My circle of influence is me. I can control my actions. I can control my choices. My kids at school are doing the 7 habits of highly effective. It's highly effective people, but they're doing the highly effective kids. And they learn like the be ready, be responsible, be respectful. And they have this little song they sing like, be proactive. I'm in charge of me. I can be responsible. A leader I'll be. I'd sing it for you, but it's probably better that I don't. I'd like you to leave today with a good opinion of me. From a young age, we're teaching our kids, like, you are in charge of you, right? Like, yes, I know that's terrible, but you have control of yourself, and you can make these changes, and you can be responsible in these kind of ways. That language is healthy for us our whole life. I can be a person who is reliable and responsible. I can be the kind of person who does what they say they will do. And if I want to have trustworthy relationships, one of the places I start is by saying, how trustworthy am I? Am I being the kind of person that follows through and does what they say they'll do? And then here's the last one I want to talk about. I wish I had like 5 hours to talk about it because it's so good and it's so meaningful and it makes such a huge impact. I promise I won't talk for 5 hours. I've got a couple minutes. Samson lacked self-control. There is so much incredible power in self-control. Now, there should have been something in Samson saying like, I don't know, maybe this isn't a good idea, right? Like, there should have been some voice popping up in Samson's mind that's like, you know, before you run off with that woman, maybe, before you tell her for a fourth time how to defeat you, maybe she's proven, right? He didn't have self-control. And self-control is that thing where we delay short-term gratification in favor of long-term outcomes. It's where we resist temptations and impulses and habits that undermine the healthy life that we're striving for. And here's the truth. We all need self-control. I mean, it does not matter what kind of background you have. It doesn't matter what kind of a life you're living. It doesn't matter how many good choices you've made, how many bad choices you've made. Every single human being absolutely needs self-control. And here's why. Our willpower, our ability to say no to the wrong things and yes to the right things, it's lacking. And here's the truth. There's all kinds of studies going into this about like how much willpower we have and what depletes our willpower and like all your attention's here so you don't have enough willpower for this hard thing over here. At the end of the day, our willpower, it gets depleted. And what happens is when we think we're in a situation where we're not going to do that thing, we have no willpower left, so we do the thing, right? Like, I am not going to eat this pizza. I'm good. I'm solid. I don't need it, right? It's not going to make my stomach happy. It's going to make my mouth happy, but not my stomach happy, right? And then we eat it. Or what happens is we say, I'm not going to buy that. I don't need it. I'm good. And then we find ourselves buying all kinds of things that we don't need. Or it looks like saying, I'm not going to go there, and then going to the place we said we wouldn't go, or I'm not going to drink that, or I'm not going to talk to them. And then it feels like we have these situations where we're like, well, I've got no self-control. I can't say no, right? Like, I guess I just don't have enough willpower, and I have to give in. And we end up doing the things we think we shouldn't do, or we don't do the things we should do. And these lapses in our willpower, it compromises our judgment and our common sense and even our confidence. Like, how many times do you have to make the same bad mistake and not feel terrible, right? It doesn't take me many, like 2 or 3 times, and I'm like, well, you're an idiot, right? Like, it fractures your confidence because you feel like a failure. You feel like, well, I've already given in so many times. This is just who I am. Why would I do anything different? But self-control is absolutely the contrast to this. And self-control says, I can manage myself. I can absolutely make changes and I can do things differently. I have the capacity to stop my emotions from taking over and keep my impulses under control. We don't have to say, well, I've got no willpower, there's nothing I can do, it's out of my control. Every single one of us has the capacity to manage our own lives. It's within each and every one of our abilities to make changes, to make wise decisions, to manage our life in the kind of way that helps us take control of who we are and who we want to be. Self-control sometimes looks like replacing a bad habit with a good habit. Sometimes it looks like knowing the things that are a problem for us and not putting ourselves in that situation. Like, if food is a problem for me, then it shouldn't be in my house, the things that I don't want to eat, right? I should just not put it there. If I'm saying no, I don't want to drink, then I shouldn't go out drinking with my friends, because guess what? It's a lot harder to say no in that environment than it is to say it outside of it. What happens is we find the tools we need and create plans to help us so that we make better decisions. I'm reading this incredible book about habits, and this is one of the best ideas that he says. He said, sometimes getting good habits isn't so much just like making them desirable as making bad habits hard. And so one of the things that he had a problem with was social media. He'd get super distracted throughout the day, right? Like, oh, I'm just going to check Facebook really quick. And then he'd lose an hour of his time. Or, oh, I'm just going to scroll Twitter for a second. And he kept finding that he would get distracted and lose a ton of time and a ton of productivity. So he had an assistant that he would have go in on Monday morning and reset all the passwords for his social media accounts. And so he literally physically couldn't access the accounts Monday through Friday. And on Saturday, she'd give him the passwords so he could go in, he could look at everything on Saturday, he could look at everything on Sunday. And then come Monday, she'd change the passwords again so that Monday through Friday, he wouldn't be distracted. He got it out of his access so he could focus on the things he wanted to focus on and had better ability to be productive in the way he wants to. Okay, that's one example. Another example he gives is like, hey, if you don't want to watch so much TV, put the remote control in a place that's harder to find it, because then you have to like be committed to get up and get the remote control and turn it on. His really extreme example was take down your TV and put it in the closet. Because then if you're really committed to that time that you're going to spend watching TV, you physically have to go get the TV, hang it up, right? Like, how many times do we say like, oh, I'm so sick of wasting time watching TV? Well, what if we just made it harder to watch TV? Then what it does is it sets us up for success in another way. Those are just silly examples, but we can do that in our life by looking at options to do something different. Where in our life do we need to be practicing more self-control? We all need self-control, and it starts with us looking at our own life and saying, where do I need to practice this more? Where have my emotions gotten away from me and I've given them the ability to run crazy for too long? Or where am I making unhealthy life choices that aren't helping me get any further ahead towards the person I want to be? Where do we need to make changes so we can start managing our life more effectively? We all need the boundaries that self-control creates in our lives. The ability to say, this is what is allowed to come in and this is what has to stay out. The ability to choose, this is good, this is healthy, this is not, this is unhealthy. And it's also true that we are healthier people with self-control. I mean, the myth, the lie that we tell ourselves is like, if I could just have whatever I want, whenever I want it, then I would be happy, right? Like, if I could just eat all of the things whenever I want to eat them, then it would be no problem. You know, just try, right? Like, just try for an entire week. What happens is you get to the end of it and you don't feel better, right? Like, your stomach's not saying, thank you, do do it again, right? You feel miserable and sluggish and you don't feel good about your choices. We never see this play out in real life. Nobody has ever just done all the things they wanted to do with no restrictions and been happier for it. Nowhere does this come true. No example of another person that it worked for. Instead, self-control creates the right limitations in our life. And within these healthy boundaries we set, within these limitations, we find health and we find happiness. The power of a life like Samson is that we can all learn from him. We can all look at these choices and we can make honest observations about the kind of people we are aspiring to be and grow from the things that we learn. But here's the interesting thing. Samson's is not the only life that the Bible gives us to contemplate, because there was another woman who had an angel show up and tell her that she would give birth to a son, and this son would be great and rescue his people. We find in him that as a child, he grew and became strong in spirit. But his life wasn't marked by selfishness or arrogance, but instead was marked by the call to heal the sick and help the poor. He showed up and fed the hungry and made room for the overlooked and the oppressed. And he was a light in the dark places and a friend to those in need. And he gave his life that we might live. And when Christ died, he did not cry out to God for revenge. He did not ask God to avenge those who had inflicted him with wounds. Instead, he cried to God, "Forgive them, because they don't know what it is that they're doing." In Christ's death, he challenged sin. He challenged death itself. He gave his life that all who believe in him might be saved. He exchanged our brokenness for his goodness, our mess for his riches. The selfishness of Samson hurt the people around him. But it is the selflessness of Jesus Christ that gives life to all who know him. The selfishness of Samson was destructive and messy, but it's the selflessness of Christ that gives us hope and freedom. In his death, Samson brought destruction on other people. But in his death, Jesus Christ gave life to all who call on him. Samson prayed for revenge, but Christ prayed for forgiveness. And while we can learn an incredible amount from a life like Samson, it is in relationship to Jesus Christ that we all learn to become better human beings. It's where we get to confront our own untrustworthiness with his faithfulness and goodness. And it's through a relationship to Jesus Christ that we learn to love and care for the well-being of those God put into our life. Because of Christ, that we can live lives that aspire to be marked by hope and goodness and forgiveness. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that you would please encourage our hearts today. I pray, Father, that we would learn to look into our own hearts and our own lives and challenge the selfishness that we see there. I pray, Father, that you would call out in us a trustworthiness that reflects the goodness of Jesus Christ. I pray that you would give us good people, Father, to do life with and call out what is best and good and noble and unique within each and every one of us. I pray, Father, that you would give us the ability to practice self-control, that we might manage our life in healthy and productive ways. Help us, I pray. I thank you for the gift of a relationship with Jesus Christ, that in him we might be saved. In his name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on Christ Church, please check us out on the web at www.christchurchohio.org. If we can be of any help to you, please contact us at 440-236-8282. Until next time, blessings to you.